And our special guest tonight, Sir Charles Schulz III. One of his works, A Fossil Hunter's Guide to Mars. We're going to talk with him about space and Mars and some other great things next on Coast to Coast AM. Sir Charles Schulz III, of course, worked at Martin Marietta Aerospace for 10 years on a weaponry system and computer-based automated test equipment. He wrote the nuclear EMP test software for the Pershing 2 missile system. He's a long-standing guest on Coast to Coast. He's back. Hey, Sir Charles, how are you?
I'm doing very well, George, and as usual, I think we're going to have a good show and a lot of fun tonight.
I am looking forward to this. Lots going on today. They're finding oceans of water on Titan, Saturn's moon. They're finding methane there. It's everywhere. Space, I think, is as mysterious and as easy to predict as we've always thought, Charles.
Well, it seems so. As we know, a lot of the chemistry and physics is the same everywhere. So we're not going to find a lot of things outside of what we imagine. We'll find a lot of things as surprises just the same, though. So it's going to be a lot of fun and a lot of excitement over the next few decades.
I think so, too. What have you been working on lately?
I'm doing a little research project here that I'm not willing to discuss just yet, but within the next 6 months, we'll probably talk about that. But making a lot of progress and doing great things.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on with NASA, if we can. In about a month, Curiosity lands on Mars. Knock on wood. What do you think of this?
I think that's a great thing. We've got so many things going on in space exploration, and it's good to have something to focus on. Mars has always been a big target, of course, because of the interest and the fascinating things we find there. Actually, the rover's got its moving, it's been moved up on its landing date. They originally thought it was going to land there on August 6th. And because of the slight course correction, they moved the landing time up about 14 hours. So it's going to land on August 5th after an eight-month journey from Earth.
You have long believed, of course, based on your work, that Mars was teeming with water, loaded with artifacts and living creatures from the past.
That's true. I would say that I wouldn't say artifacts, but I would certainly point out fossils, organisms, and other things of that sort. Water, as you know, is the key to it all. And over the last few months, they've made some major announcements about the existence of water on Mars and how it's modified its environment. And they've recently stated that the planet's sopping wet inside, which is not a surprise because when you think about it, Mars, like Earth, is a terrestrial planet formed from the same materials at the same time. And it would not be a surprise if you discover water is inside that planet as well. I mean, think about it. When volcanoes erupt on the Earth, most of what comes out of the volcano is water vapor. In some cases, 95% of it. That's why the big clouds of steam. So a planet like Mars, with volcanoes and water inside, would have the ability to support a biosphere for many billions of years.
You know, Sir Charles, years ago I told a planetary scientist that the universe is the same. I said everything's made out of the same primordial soup. Everything. And, you know, we might get some unusual elements here and there, but by and large, it's all the same. And, you know, he stopped and he thought for a moment. He said, you know what? You're right. And so it is not unusual if we can find water on a planet that is relatively warm. I think we're going to have life on it.
Well, there's no question in my mind whatsoever. As everybody knows, I've been a longtime supporter of the idea, and the images that I've posted show a lot of material that I'm certain is fossil remains. So we're going to see a lot of information on that very soon when Curiosity does make its landing. And I think it's not going to surprise us eventually to discover that all throughout the universe, life is everywhere.
What will Curiosity's capabilities be?
Well, you know, it's much bigger than the other two rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. Curiosity is about the size of a small car, and it's about five times larger than the previous two rovers. It weighs almost 900 kilograms, or almost 2,000 pounds. It's about 10 feet long, nuclear-powered, and it can run at night, which is very important. They couldn't do any nighttime operations with the existing rovers. This will give us some capabilities that we don't have. And the bulk of scientific instrumentation that this new rover carries is about 10 times greater than the instruments loaded on the previous rovers as well. So we've got a full-color magnifier microscope that has white LEDs to illuminate it so you can get a true color image of what you're looking at. And it also has ultraviolet LEDs. These will allow you to look for fluorescent compounds such as minerals and even biological molecules. So this is going to be a very important piece of instrumentation.
Well, those two past rovers, too, Opportunity being one of them, of course, you know, they're hugely successful.
They were only projected to last like 90 days, and they've been running for years. They originally landed at the end of 2003, beginning of 2004, and even though Spirit is bogged down and unable to run now, they termed it a stationary science station for a while there. Opportunity is still on the move and doing a lot of exploration and sending back images. I saw new images just earlier this morning. So immensely successful.
And in some of these images, you have seen what you think might be fossils, right?
That's correct. And many of them appear very, very similar to the sorts of life that we have on Earth. And, you know, when you think about it, an aquatic environment, Mars appeared to have oceans, big oceans in the past, that would have covered possibly half of the planet or more. So it doesn't surprise me in the least, and it shouldn't surprise anyone, that life evolving in an organism base in an ocean would be very similar to what we see in our own oceans. You know, sand dollars, sea urchins, trilobites, squid, that sort of thing. We're going to see that anywhere in the universe. You've got an ocean and the conditions are right.
So the cameras from Curiosity will give us better quality.
Yes, they should. They have a 1600 by 1200 pixel imager on the mast cam, and it's supposed to be a true color camera this time. Instead of using the color filters to construct the color images in the way we've seen in the past, this camera is supposed to take true color images and digitize them and send them back. And it's really, it's a cinematic quality camera. Now, they had plans in the past, and James Cameron, the director, was a large part of this project, to put high-resolution zoom on the camera, and it's basically a movie camera. And unfortunately, they had some mechanical and control difficulties and time constraints in testing the control hardware, so they had to leave out the zoom lenses, but they still can get some excellent true-color pictures. At least that's what it is billed as, and we'll see what comes out of it over the next few months.
Yeah, once it lands, how quickly will we start getting some good images?
Well, you know, normally when they land, they'll get a couple of images right away to test the hardware because, you know, people are just dying with curiosity, so to speak, to see if the hardware actually survives the landing. So I would imagine we're going to see some tentative images right away, and then within the week, we'll probably have some pretty spectacular pictures. It doesn't take long to get a piece of hardware like this working as long as everything has survived the trip and the landing.
Where have they decided to land the Curiosity?
Well, you know, they picked out an area at the bottom of a lake bed, basically, and it's in an area called Gale Crater. Iolas Pallas is the name of the region, and that zone is in an area where water would have been present for a great period of time, and it gives them a very high probability of finding any fossil remains in that area, and it is in an area that is loaded with material that appear to be hydrated minerals. So this is a very good chance to see how well they can detect the existence of water and the effect it has had on the minerals there, as well as looking for biological molecules.
Do you think if there was something that truly looked like a life form, that they would let us see it?
Well, you know, I have to point out that in the past, for the most part that I'm aware of, the pictures were not censored. They sent them right out immediately or within a couple of days.
Right.
And because of that, and partly because some of the things would have been very hard to recognize perhaps, most of the imagery came out right away without any issue. That could very well be the case here. I couldn't speak for, you know, who's making a decision about what gets released or not, but I certainly hope that they release them at least as quickly and with as much material as they did in the past mission. That would be very helpful for many people.
But they generally release them, Charles, don't they, without comment?
Normally they do. If you go to the site, you'll notice that there are many sorts of annotations that accompany the pictures, such as what filters were used, where it was taken, the time, and that sort of information, which for a lot of people, you know, boring. But when you really come down to it, it helps you understand a lot more about the processes involved. It helps you understand what you're looking at and why. They do put notes on over the next few days explaining a lot more about the pictures. And if you go to the analyst's handbook, which they have for the old rovers, you'll find tons of information.
Why do we continue to go to Mars? I'm glad we do, without a definitive manned space program.
You know, that's an excellent question, and I'll tell you something. even though our space program appears to be at a standstill, there's a great deal of commercial activity at this time, and that's going to be our backbone. It really is. Companies have started up within the last few years that have successfully created and flown spacecraft and even done supply missions to the International Space Station. So you can bet that if we need something launched, whether NASA has the capability or not, or whether they can get it from the Russians or not, isn't even an issue at this point for most missions. There's a lot of stuff you can fly much more economically and in a mass-produced craft that has a lot of reliability. I think that this is going to be a huge factor in our exploration of space. And the reason we go to Mars is because it is so Earth-like, and it presents us with opportunities to discover a lot about the development of life. And again, we got to face the fact that Mars is a fascinating place. We expect a lot there. It's been theorized about for so many years, and finally, we're pulling the lid off of it. We're seeing what's going on there, and we're getting some satisfaction, some real answers.
What's new in the world of checking for planets across this universe?
You know, that's been a fascinating thing. Over the last few years, they've looked for planets all over, trying to discover if there were any outside of our own solar system. And up until recently, that was not a resolved question. Now, they have almost 800 planets so far that they've discovered outside of our solar system. And some of them are just a hop, skip, and a jump away from us. In fact, four of the extrasolar planets they've discovered are actually in the life-supporting zones of the stars they orbit, which means that on those planets, all other things being equal, it's quite possible that there's liquid water and perhaps life. Of course, we don't have the ability to see the planets themselves in any sort of detail if we can see them at all. The difficulty is a planet is so tiny and so dim compared to a star, it's impossible to spot without some pretty advanced hardware. So at this point, we use a lot of tricks to find the things. But so far, we've got four that look like possible candidates for life outside our solar system. And that's very exciting.
They're almost like, when we spot them, they're almost like the Venus transit, where you spot this little object going across its sun, right?
Well, you're exactly on target. That's how many of them are found. You look at the light from that star and how much intensity it has, and over time, you see if something passes in front of it. And that transit, or passing in front of the star, dims the light slightly, and that allows you to determine the size of the planet and the speed at which it's orbiting it. So it's a very useful process, but it only works for planets that actually pass between us and that sun. In most cases, that won't be there. In most cases, what they actually look at is called radial velocity. You can measure the speed the star itself is moving and the slight wobbles in it that a planet's gravity makes, because imagine having a weight on a string and slinging it around your head slowly. It would pull you back and forth as it swung around. And in the same way, planets cause a star to wobble when they orbit it, because they're tethered to it by gravity. So we can look at that little bit of wobble because of the spectrum shifting slightly in the light from that star, and that's how most planets are discovered.
Did you always believe, Sir Charles, that there might be many Earth-like planets out there?
I've always believed that there were many, many planets in our galaxy, and just by extrapolation, there had to be a pretty large number of habitable planets. Earth-like might be a bit of a stretch. There may be a few million Earth-like planets in our galaxy, or even a few billion. At this point, we don't really have enough information to say for certain, but I know that they're out there. I mean, the sheer numbers dictate that it has to happen.
And well, and if they are, and I agree with you there, then can we also use that same multiplication factor and ascertain that, yeah, there's probably intelligent life out there on a percent of them?
Well, we could, but the problem is we only have one sample to deal with, and so you can't really plot a graph or derive a trend based on one sample. We only have one known sample of intelligent life in the universe on this planet, and so we couldn't really extrapolate. But we could say, you know, it seems reasonable, which is, you know, it's a different thing, but it gives the same sort of satisfaction to a lot of people.
What does your scientific gut tell you about the possibilities of intelligent life out there?
I don't doubt that there's plenty of intelligent life in our galaxy and throughout the universe. But I would probably say that at this particular moment, there may be as many as 50,000 or 100,000 civilizations. And the reason I put the number as low as that is because realize that a civilization has a lifespan, and a planet lives a lot longer than a civilization.
Right.
In all the history of the Earth, which is about 4.6 billion years, we've only been around for about the last million or less, depending on, you know, what you consider human.
Mm-hmm.
So the bulk of time is no intelligent life and then a tiny sliver of time with intelligent life. And what happens afterwards? Do they kill themselves off, or do they go somewhere else, or what happens? We don't really know. With only one sample, again, to draw any conclusions on, it's impossible to say what happens after they reach the technical stage or possibly something far more advanced than us.
See, if I've always thought that they reach a certain level, then something happens, whatever it might be, whether it's their own internal conflict or an asteroid wipes them out or something, and then they're all gone. They're obliterated for hundreds of millions of years,
and then
it starts all over again.
It's a very good possibility, and it's something that's been discussed in great detail, and it's also the fodder of many science fiction stories, because it's possible that many races reach a point where they have a nuclear war and wipe themselves out. I mean, we were very close to that at some points in our own history, and we can't really say we're any better off right now. But it could well be that something other happens, and it's often referred to recently as the singularity, and people feel that as computers advance and our use of computers and information processing advances, we reach a point where something amazing and unpredictable we can't even describe might happen that makes a race vanish. And it may be that they simply digitize themselves and pull the lid over themselves and vanish, or it could be that something happens that makes them, I don't know, it's impossible to say. But it surely raises a lot of questions, because when we look at the skies, we don't really have any good solid evidence of any other races out there yet. No radio signatures or optical signals that we can really hang our hat on.
You know, when you look at things that have been going on and we're seeing these planets, I wonder what SETI's trying to do. And they've been on the program a lot. Seth Shostak has. They're good people. But they may have technology that's not going to work, Sir Charles.
You know what? I've thought about that a long time. And I even mentioned, I think, in a previous show, a little bit of my thoughts on that. But I think I can make it pretty clear.
Sure.
SETI is looking at a specific section of the radio spectrum. And in fact, it's the water hole, the hydrogen wavelengths. And because of that, they only examine a tiny, tiny sliver of the possible radio signals. And the assumption is life will say, hey, you know, we're based on water and carbon, and we're going to use the water hole frequencies. But we don't broadcast on those frequencies, so why would we assume that they would? I think it would be far more reasonable to do something like create a signal based on a mathematical constant. Let's say we take the water hole as a basis and multiply it by a mathematical constant like pi or e or the golden ratio. And if you were to find signals at those multiples or some harmonic of that, then you would know that you had somebody who had to actually think to create that radio wave, something very unlikely to happen in nature. And if they were on two or three such frequencies, then you'd know you had nailed a real signal.
Well, that's true. That's absolutely true. I just wonder if they're wasting their time. What do you think?
No, you know, anything that you do that helps you add a little bit to your knowledge isn't really a waste of time. I often look at people who say, well, that was a failure. And I go, no, it wasn't a failure. It was a learning experience. And SETI, whether they produce solid results or not, is a learning experience. They've developed some pretty amazing analysis technology and computer technology to look for and decode signals, and that alone has been a great contribution. So the effort itself is really worthwhile, whether you get an answer or not.
Do you believe that this planet has been visited by intelligent life forms from out there?
Well, I wouldn't even say believe. I see that as a possibility, and it's not one we can discount. It is quite possible. I haven't seen anything that convinces me is solid evidence of it. But it is quite possible.
Well, they're definitely not coming here under our known propulsion system, that's for sure.
No, that's certainly true. And, you know, that raises a number of questions. How do you travel between the stars in a reasonable period of time? And it turns out there may be some very simple ways to do it, and we could be very well on the verge of figuring those out. And one of them is a reactionless thruster based on something known as Mach's principle. And that's something that's gotten a lot of press lately. In essence, you take a tiny piece of mass and quantum fluctuations that make the mass increase or decrease slightly at random can be used, if you wobble the mass, to produce a thrust without having to throw away an exhaust. So basically think of it as a quantum mechanics device that could produce thrust in one direction without throwing exhaust out the other side.
Stay with us, Sir Charles. We're going to take this break. We're going to come back, talk more with you about a lot of this, including, of course, later, mind uploading. Was that possible to really upload things with the mind? And also, I've got to get your take on why you think we are here as human beings. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast with Sir Charles Schulz III. Charles, we're going to talk about many things with you tonight, indeed. But if you think there's life out there in the universe, what do you think it is? Plant life primarily? Little organisms? What might be there?
I would say that overall, we're going to find that most of the bulk of life in the universe is going to consist of microorganisms. And the reason for that is they're the simple, basic things that can absorb energy, such as light or heat, live off chemicals, even minerals and rocks, and don't need a whole lot of water in many cases. So it's very probable that the most primitive and simple form of life, bacteria, fungi, that sort of thing, will be what we'll find almost everywhere. And complex life will be a little more hard to find.
What was so special about Earth? I mean, when you look at it, I mean, it's teeming with life, all kinds of creatures, plant life, animals, insects, humans,
well, that's
all kinds
true.
Of things.
Yeah, and it's not that the planet itself is special. It just is a very good environment for life. And many people, you know, feel that the Earth has something very special about it because it's so perfect for us. I think what we really have to do is turn the view around and say, we are developed to be perfect for this particular environment. If you went to the inside of one of the caves that's nearly oxygen-free, it's loaded with life, but we couldn't live there for more than a minute or two holding our breath. If you go deep under the oceans where the volcanic vents are, there are things that live down there, and they're perfectly suited there. They're very comfortable, but it's a completely inhospitable environment for us. And so when we start looking at where things live and what sorts of things live there, we have to look at the organisms themselves as being special, not the environment they're in. When you look at it from that standpoint, there should be life all over the universe, because no matter where you go, if you can find energy, a little bit of a solvent such as water, and the material for them to eat, you're going to find something living there.
That's right. You heat it up a little bit, there it is.
Well, that's right. The energy to drive it happens to be there. It's going to happen.
Let's look at this in kind of a metaphysical way for just a moment. This planet, and there's no doubt about it, because many pharmaceutical drugs are based on natural plants. This planet seems to have remedies for ills that we suffer. You got a headache, willow bark is where they got the aspirin, things like that. To me, that sounds like something intelligent created it. It just doesn't pop up in nature. It can't. It's impossible.
Well, that's not exactly true. If you look at how many organisms there are on this planet, and there are millions of organisms, when you look at that, everyone has a little bit different chemistry. Mm-hmm. If you look long and hard enough, you're bound to find something that will have some use for you. It's just that the molecules themselves are so darn useful for transforming one chemical into another, or for turning on or turning off the processes in cells. So all of these molecules, in a sense, are building blocks and messengers that control how life operates. When you have enough different organisms, you're going to have enough different messages that if you look around, you'll find something useful. If you take a cup of dirt, just a cup of soil, you're bound to find 50,000 different species of organism living in it. And many of them have never even been studied or classified before. When you come down to it, pharmaceutical companies often take little more than a cup of dirt to look for new remedies. When we start looking at life in other planets and in other biospheres, we're certain to find other remedies that don't have anything to do with the chemistry here on Earth, but will prove very useful for us just the same.
Well, that's, I guess, adds the second question. Why the remedies? I mean, how does that happen?
It's because our bodies are extremely complicated devices, and every cell is like a factory. And the cells use chemistry to transform foods and energy. They use chemistry to build new cells and to repair cells. Basically, the chemistry is everything. It's a natural form of nanotechnology. And when you start looking at how the cells function, if something goes wrong and you find the right message for your cell or the right chemistry to help it process something or defeat a problem, it doesn't matter where it comes from and it doesn't matter what it is. There could be 1,000 different remedies for any given illness as long as they provide the same thing to the cell that it needs.
Okay, here's where it gets even more interesting. We need to eat. We have a mouth. We need to breathe. We have a nose. We need to hear. We have ears. We need to see. We have eyes. We need to feel. We need to touch. We need thumbs if we're going to start building things. How did that happen?
Well, that's actually simpler than it sounds. If you look at an animal that lives in a certain environment, and it's not quite suited for the environment, it might muddle along, and some of its offspring over time are better adapted. Think about how well children are adapted to computers, and those of us born before they were around sometimes have quite a difficult time with them. And that's not a, that's just a trivial example, but imagine wolves and rabbits. Wolves are going to chase down and eat the slowest rabbits. The fast rabbits are the ones that reproduce, and their children carry the genes for being faster, more fit. And in every environment, over time, there's a winnowing effect where the forces of nature either work with you or conspire against you based on how you respond to your environment. It's not what you are, it's how you respond to it. And in the end, those organisms that are most fit, have the best characteristics for the environment they live in, will do well. And that's one of the reasons when something like a volcanic eruption or an asteroid strike starts killing off life, that's why it happens, because they're not adapted for that change of condition. And it resets the clock and everything starts over and has to start finding a new set of solutions.
Why life? Why did it start?
Actually, it's a race between those who have the belief in something mystical, like God creating it, or the fact that we can see chemistry works the way it is, and the universe seems to be an incubator for life. Something that was told to me recently struck me as funny, and then it made perfect sense. Organization, as you know, does proceed from randomness. What he pointed out was randomness or chaos is unstable. It's going to result in organization eventually. In other words, if you throw a bunch of dice for 1,000 years, eventually you'll get a pattern where you have, for instance, all sixes. And all the molecules around us, all the energy and chemistry driving it, eventually they come together to form something that reacts in some way to the environment. And it's strange, because if you look at the primitive atmosphere of our planet and you look at how compounds formed in it, from ultraviolet, from the sunlight and starlight, from lightning discharges, the molecules that form are the same ones that will form everywhere in the universe under those conditions. And those molecules tend to be active in a certain way. If you take those materials, and the material that's formed has a name, it's called tholin. If it dries out on a volcanic rock and it gets ground up a little with erosion and it gets wet, it forms proteins. They automatically arrive just because of chemistry and physics. And over time, those proteins form membranes when they get into solution. They start processing chemistry inside differently from the ocean water around them on the outside. It's just a downhill process, and once it starts, it proceeds very rapidly. I mean, some of the fossils they found here on Earth show that life was probably around 4 billion years ago. So in the first 600 million years of this planet's history, something happened that formed life that quickly and that easily. And knowing that, we should see life, simple life forms at least, all over the universe where the conditions are right.
Can I ask you if you believe in a divine power?
Actually, I do. And, you know, I've got my own reasons for believing that. But, you know, people can argue it both ways. One thing they have to realize is, at this point, it's not something you can prove. It's basically an article of faith. And what really stretches your mind is to think that no matter where you live, no matter what universe you happen to be in, mathematics and order and structure are at the heart of it all. And it's something you can always count on. And any god, if there's one or many, any god is going to use mathematics as a basic tool, because that's what's there.
Well, there's no doubt about that. That is true. I have a difficult time, Sir Charles, trying to, you know, comprehend the Big Bang theory. I'm beginning to believe in the multiverse theory.
There's nothing wrong with that. You know,
no.
Stop and think about it. Any number of universes could exist side by side, one dimension apart from each other, in a sense. And we could actually be, think of it like a cluster of grapes expanding from an original chaotic universe. That universe could be utterly chaotic, no time or space as we know it. And every now and then, out of the randomness, over time scales that don't even make sense, a universe could be born. And like clusters of grapes, they could be different universes hanging on this larger structure, call it a metaverse. And basically, our physics isn't to the point where we can even explore that concept very well, but it's a very popular one with mathematical analysis and cosmologists these days. There could be millions, billions of universes side by side with our own.
Is it possible that this belief system is just, you know, is natural, that you know, if one wants to believe in God, that's fine. If you want to believe in the scientific end, that's fine.
That sort of a belief is actually the beginning of the questioning things around you. You know, we're looking for answers. And believe it or not, the innate desire to have a religious explanation could actually be the same roots of scientific inquiry, because it makes you wonder, what's going on? How did it all come to be? In many cases, cultures came up with stories to explain things. They were looking for logical, step-by-step explanations for the creation. And in technical terms, we start actually asking the questions and taking the bits apart and seeing what makes sense and what doesn't. And it's strange that many of the early myths that we have about the formation of the universe and the creation of life actually hold up pretty well in some sense when you start comparing what actually happened. I'll give you an example. In the first chapter in Genesis in the Bible, it says that the world was made before there was light. And, you know, we find that the planets existed before the sun ignited. That's very odd. Somebody either knew what they were talking about or it was a happy accident, one or the other.
Do you sometimes ask yourself, what's this all about?
I have. And, you know, I can't say that I could really give you a good answer, but I like to think that at some point, the universe leads to intelligence, which can in turn appreciate and understand the universe. And eventually, we reach a point where we either figure out whether the universe is going to end or not, and whether there's anything we can do about it or not. I think that in part, it's a lot tied into what you would consider valuable. And information is always the answer. Think about what would happen if, let's say, aliens came to our world and they wanted to trade with us. What would they trade? They wouldn't want precious metals. There's more of it in space than you could ever possibly want. They wouldn't want food. We're probably protein incompatible, and we're pretty dirty animals and hard to raise and ornery. And they wouldn't want our water. There's more water in space than you could use. What would they want? And the answer would be culture, art, mathematics, new equations, new thoughts, music. The taste of the exotic and the alien. That's what they would want, just as what we would want when we travel and we explore. I think that in the end, the information, the form the information is in, the sense of something new, something novel and different, is what really drives all of us.
Well, I think so too. Will we ever get these answers? Will we ever really understand what it's all about?
We may not get them in our lifetimes, but eventually I think we will have them. It's just inevitable. The universe is huge, and we are learning a lot about our place in it and how to manipulate it around us. And as we grow in our technical prowess and as we learn how to do things, we'll spread out from our planet to other planets in this solar system. We'll spread out to the nearby stars, and we'll start learning about what's going on in our stellar neighborhood and in our neighborhood in this part of the galaxy. Eventually, we'll either find other intelligences or their remnants or not. But whatever happens, we're going to continue to expand and grow and learn, and we will learn a lot of answers on the way.
Sir Charles, scientists at CERN have said that they may have found the God particle. They're going to announce something on Wednesday. If they do, and then they have a better understanding of science and physics and the formation of the universe, is that going to revolutionize things, or is it going to be just life as usual?
Well, it could revolutionize things, but one realization is very important here. Understanding that whether the Higgs vector boson exists or not isn't the real issue. What really is that no matter what we discover, it's going to take a little time before it reaches practical applications. In the past, that's been about 50 years from the time an idea comes about to the time it becomes a product or a service or something we see every day. If we really discover that the Higgs vector boson is real, for instance, one of the first things they'll try to figure out is what it means. And one very important result is it possibly was the reason for the universe expanding very rapidly at its beginning. And so this would help us answer some questions about the early history of the universe, where it came from and why it did so the way it did. That's one of the things they're trying to figure out.
Well, maybe so. Maybe so. It's pretty exciting, though, isn't it?
Well, it's a fascinating thing. We're living in a time where the information and the discoveries are coming faster and faster, so quickly that nobody can become an expert in their field anymore. There's just too much to know.
And yet you will say, and you freely admitted, that if somebody has this belief system, we'll call it God, we'll call it a higher power, whatever it may be, that's okay too.
Oh, absolutely right. Whatever you need as your intellectual tools or your emotional tools to get you through life and to get things working the way you need them to work, to get your results out of the universe and to live successfully, it doesn't matter. If your belief serves you, that's wonderful. But one thing we have to be cautious about is at any time the rug can be pulled out from under us. And this happens many times with religious beliefs. It happens many times with technical beliefs. Just a few years ago, Newton ruled, and then Einstein came along, and everything changed. Quantum mechanics came along, and it changed the way people appreciate the way our universe works. Anytime, anything you know could be proven false. Remember that in science, everything is basically a hypothesis. We get closer and closer approximations to the truth, and we work with them until they don't work anymore.
Is there anything out there that would just rattle and shake the foundations of science?
Oh, sure. If we could prove the universe was a simulation, that would pretty much shake everybody up.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, I think on the other hand, anybody who plays a video game would go, oh, yeah, I figured that out.
Well, that's true, too. That is true, too. And where is science taking us, though, Sir Charles? I mean, what's next for us to truly develop?
Well, I'll tell you this much. One thing I've discovered is just looking at how history has gone and how science has gone. From the beginning of our history, we've tried to change the world around us to our liking. And everything we learned has given us a little bit of leverage around the reality so that we learned how to sharpen a stick and heat the point up in the fire and catch that animal over there that could provide food for our family for another few days. And as we learned new tricks, we became more and more adept at controlling our environment, or at least making it a little more comfortable. I think that as the years go by, when you look at it, our trend is to learn more and more to give us more ability to control our environment so we can be more satisfied with what we have. I think that really, in the end, it's all about learning to control. And that seems to be where we're headed.
Do you think mankind will be around in another couple hundred years?
I think that's kind of a tricky question, because at the rate things are going, we may very well end up at some point where mankind and machine reach some sort of a hybrid or a point of merging. The ability to process information the way a computer does and the ability to do things that machines do gives us so much power and flexibility that it becomes very attractive. And even now, we see people with, transplanted organs or artificial valves in their heart or stents or other things that are added into the body, replacement hips and joints. And now we're seeing artificial limbs. And now they're talking about sensory implants that replace the ear and the eye. And some ear and eye implants have been done. Now we're talking about replacing neural tissue. We're getting to the point where we can't really even say if there will be pure humans left in 200 years. I suspect that what will really happen is we'll end up with some sort of a hybrid, and there may even be a protected colony of pure humans just to say we've still got them and they're not extinct.
The great baseball player Ted Williams, his head has been cryogenically frozen because one day they're hoping to clone his body and download his memory.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, many people have heard the stories about Walt Disney's head being frozen. And there are a number of people who have opted for cryogenic storage because it keeps the body from decaying, and it's expected that at some point we will have the technology to either read what's in their minds and reconstruct them from that, or to clone a new body and load them into the body. But you see, we're reaching another point where computers may give us a completely different spin on things.
And that's... Let's talk about that when we come back in a moment.